Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk preview podcast for this week. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thank you so much for joining us. With a couple of surprising results today, combined with the news that Antonio Conte is set to join Chelsea, I am joined by World Soccer Talk alum and Chelsea fan, Morgan Green. Morgan, thanks for being back on the World Soccer Talk podcast.
It is good to be back, Nipun. Thank you for dragging me out of the darkness and the wilderness to bring me back.
Well, that mustache of yours needs to be heard from time to time, so we're glad you're back on the pod world. So with Morgan, we're going to talk about a variety of things today. Obviously, the Champions League results. We're going to preview the weekend's results and then, of course, talk about Antonio Conte. So in section one, we're going to do Champions League. Morgan, let's just get right into it. The results from yesterday, Barcelona beating Atleti 2-1, Bayern winning 1-0 Benfica. The Barcelona game, let's start with that, because I think most people would have watched that, myself included. I was watching that live and then caught the Bayern game later. I was pretty interested by the way Barcelona set up in this game. Atleti really had the beating of them for first 25 minutes. Barcelona did not create much except for a couple of chances that Neymar missed. I'm wondering what you thought in the way that Barcelona set up. There was almost a sense of, okay, we are at home, we are going to win this, we're not going to get scored on, and then your beloved Fernando Torres scored.
Yeah, and honestly, it's, you know, Torres, if he's got one team that he scores against, as we've seen from the numbers, it is Barcelona. I mean, he always seems to pop up against them.
Yeah.
He's done it for years now.
Although there was no Gary Neville this time to go.
No, well, there was no happy.
Right, exactly.
Bloody, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, as far as the setup and everything, at this point, Atletico have built such a name for themselves over the past couple of years with Simeone that you're seeing teams start to, you know, try to prepare for that. It's not just, okay, we have to set up in a certain way just so we can beat Real Madrid and Barcelona. It's,
right.
Okay, we have to throw Atletico Madrid into that. And you're seeing it now with the big boys, too. I mean, before, you know, you'd have a third-place team that was 20, 30 points off between the top two. Now you've got Atletico that's actually challenging on there. So Barcelona, Real Madrid are having to change their tactics up just for Atletico. So I wasn't too shocked in the way that they set up. I didn't get a chance to watch the whole game. I just saw the highlights from seeing everything on there, especially the way that it played out in the first half, really feeling them out. They let Atletico kind of have the better of the game at that point. And then the second half just kind of Suarez did what Suarez does. And yeah, they ended up winning the game. So, it, you know, as far as the setup goes, yeah, not very shocking at all that you're seeing this now with teams playing against Atletico Madrid like that.
Yeah, I agree with you. The Suarez thing is interesting, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But, you know, from an Atleti perspective, I keep thinking to myself, the way that they set up in the midfield with Gabi, Koke, and Niguez. And in fact, Koke was involved in the build-up, an excellent assist for Torres's goal. And I can't help but think that they, for the majority of the game, structurally had a big upper hand over Busquets and Rakitic. I thought Iniesta got on the ball a little bit, was able to drive forward, but did not have enough of an influence to have an assist or spread the ball too much. But at least he was able to have an impact. So other than Iniesta, I thought Barcelona's midfield really struggled. Busquets' major contribution to the game was getting a couple of yellow cards for Madrid's team. So from those perspectives, as well as the goal that was conceded, you have to worry about Barcelona going back next week for Wednesday night's game.
You do a little bit. The only thing that's really hurting Madrid, Atletico Madrid at this point, is the fact that when you get a goal outside of Antoine Griezmann, it's a blessing. I mean, he's been the only guy. I think he's, what's he at now, 24 goals?
Yeah, he's 22, I think. Yeah, 24.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Niguez is at like 8, and he's the second leading scorer. So, I mean, it really does come down to if you can negate you can negate Antoine Griezmann, you've got a good chance of at least drawing Atletico Madrid at this point. I think Barcelona kind of almost dared them, okay, you know, let Torres beat us, let, you know, Yannick Ferrer Carrasco beat us, let somebody else score for them. We know in our hearts, if we really push forward and we can try and put it together, we know one of the three, Neymar, Messi, or Suarez, is going to score at least one.
Yeah.
And they ended up getting two. So you're going to see, I think, again, in the second leg, almost that daring look where we're going to make sure that Griezmann's a non-factor. And with now Torres being out for the next one, it's going to be Ferrer Carrasco and maybe Luciano Vietto. Or maybe he's going to, you know, maybe he'll throw another midfielder on. Yeah. I don't know what Simeone is going to do. But, you know, they're going to have to find one more guy to try and step up and score outside of Griezmann, because I highly doubt Atletico is going to let him run right, especially with it being as close as it is now.
Yeah, Carrasco is a good shout there, Morgan, because I thought he was the best player for Atletico, other than maybe Gabby. I thought he was terrific. Got past the defense multiple times. I thought Alves was found out a couple of times. Alves had another poor game. I thought he was very poor in the El Clasico. Again, I've done that again, in El Clasico. Again, I thought he was fairly poor in this game. So Carrasco is a good shout. You talk about Torres missing. I think Suarez will be missing for the return leg. I think, I don't know if you got a chance to see his kick out at Juan Fran, but I think he will get a retrospective ban for that. Did you get a chance to see that?
I did not get a chance to see it, no.
So
like
what?
I was in the bar last night when I caught most of mine, so it was kind of in between pints.
Yeah, so what happened was Juan Fran and so Suarez has the ball. Has a heavy touch. Juan Fran clears it, and Suarez, for absolutely no reason, has a kick out at him. Clear as day. The referee had already turned his back, so he didn't see it. So I really do believe there will be retrospective punishment, in which case Suarez will be missing for the return leg, which will have huge consequences, I think, because I thought Messi was poor. I thought Neymar was probably the one getting most involved, but his heading let him down. He hit the post. He got involved, but he wasn't at his clinical best. So those are things we'll think about for next week. Let's move ahead to the Bayern-Benfica game. Early second-minute goal by the Chilean Arturo Vidal was really the difference maker here between Bayern Munich and Portugal's leaders, Benfica. In the starting lineup, we saw the usual mix. We saw Ribery start. He's pretty much back to full fitness at this point. He's been working himself back over the last month or so. For Benfica, the big talking points was Gaetan as well, who had a good game. The way I look at this was Bayern was good for the first 5 minutes they scored, and for the last 10 minutes where they felt like, hey, looks like we don't, this 1-0 result isn't good enough. Let us try to get another one. And between that, it was a lot of sideways passing, a lot of lack of penetration, and you can argue that Benfica could have had a goal.
Yeah, and honestly, this is one that I caught a few of the highlights on. You know, to me, Bayern at this point in the Guardiola era with Bayern Munich, with them already knowing that he's going, obviously I'm not saying that anybody's going to lay off on there, but I think that he's probably going to be he seems to be setting up a little bit differently to me, at least from, you know, some of the games that I've watched, some of the highlights that I've seen with them.
How so?
And like you said, well, I mean, it's again, the 5 minutes at the beginning and then just kind of do whatever we got to do and then try and get a late goal on.
Right.
Like something like this. That's not a way that you set up as a dominant team, which is what Bayern Munich are, which is what they should be. They, against a team like Benfica, who again are a good team, they've got very good players, they've got young players,
good defensively,
Heard of. But you know, when you've got firepower like Lewandowski, Ribery, you've got the, you know, Douglas Costas, Thomas Muller, I mean, these are guys that should be scoring against everybody.
Yeah, sounds like some pretty good players.
Yeah,
we've heard of a few of them.
Would you be shocked if Bayern Munich won this game 4-0? No, absolutely not. You'd expect it almost. So the fact that they did go in 1-0, it kind of makes you wonder, you know, what are they doing? I mean, what's the mentality of Pep? What's the mentality of the team at this point? Because, you know, these are games that even last year or the year before, I mean, they would roll over Benfica, all over them, and embarrass them. I mean, Lewandowski would have one of his 5-goal games.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it is a little worrying for me, if I'm a Bayern Munich fan. They're definitely going to go through, I'd say, even though, you know, Benfica is a tough place to play. So, yeah, that's one thing on there. But I don't think that they have the strikers. I mean, you look at, like, Jonas Mitroglou. I mean, Gaetan's always dangerous. But, you know, a guy like Mitroglou playing striker, he's not somebody who's going to be very quick. He's not very athletic. He's more of a, you know, reactionary striker. You know, like he'll get the ball and take a hit, or if he gets a good header in the box. And I think that Byron's defense is good enough to be able to mark him out of a game. And he does get marked out of games easily. Unfortunately, we've seen it not just at the club level, but we've also seen it at the international level with him as well. So I'd be shocked if he started the second game for them, needing a goal like this. They might put some more athletic players in, or some more players who are a little bit more energetic to kind of cause that chaos in the back.
Yeah, Bayern's defensive problems, I think you hinted at those, are going away. They are getting better because they've got some bodies back. You know, going into the game against Juventus, they were really struggling for defensive players, but they have got some of those players back. Kimmich played, Alaba played, and Lahm, the ever-present Lahm, also played. So, Philip Lahm, we just don't know where he'll play. He'll always play. We just don't know where. Midfield, left back, right back, center back.
Striker.
Goalkeeper. So, yeah, I think I'm with you. I think the 1-0 should have been more. We agree on base of talent. But I cannot see Benfica scoring in the way, in the leg away from at home. So you still think, I still think Bayern are firm favorites to go through. Let's move ahead to talking about the club that Guardiola will be going to. Getting a very good result away, City 2-2 at PSG. I thought, Morgan, tactically the game was really well set up by both managers. I know Blanc gets a lot of criticism sometimes. I thought he got his tactics right. But it came down to individual errors for me and huge turnovers in midfield. These are things that led to all the goals. Every single goal in this game was either error in midfield or an error in defense. And including, you know, the likes of your beloved David Luiz, who, you know, there's always an error in that guy, right? And then Fernando as well. I don't know what Fernando was thinking with the first touch he had. Yaya, I think that we should mention is Yaya is still injured. I think that probably contributed. But at the end of the day, this is an incredible result for Man City away from home.
It is. And I think that at this point, you know, Pellegrini obviously knows he's out. He's going to be auditioning for his next job. And for him to really make an impact on this team, it's going to be how far he can take them in the Champions League.
Right.
I mean, we all agree on that. If he does somehow magically take them to, you know, the finals, God forbid they end up winning it, I'd feel good for Kartik, but I wouldn't like to see that myself.
Right.
But if they do that, then he kind of etches himself into that, and he really validates himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Pellegrini is a manager, and I'm sure Kartik has droned on about this for a long time. I know we have. He really is kind of – I think he's underrated as a manager. He's a very good manager. He's one that I would have liked to have seen at Chelsea several years ago.
He's too classy for Chelsea, Morgan, but that's a different thing. Go on.
No, he's not. No, he took the real – Madrid job, trust me, he's not too classy at Chelsea. But you know, he is, though. I mean, he's a good manager, so he knows what he has to do. I mean, he's got to the latter stages of this competition with a lot less than he's had at City. So it's really a you know, I think what you're seeing now, the performances you're going to see out of City, I mean, it's going to be hard fought. You know, this return leg is going to be huge when they go back to the Etihad. And I think PSG, you know, the other thing with PSG is they've been in this situation before against English opposition, and they've come out on top. So it's this is new ground for City. PSG know what they have to do. They know how to win it. Both teams have immense talent. I just feel like, you know, PSG with the experience they have, the talent, and the fact that they do have such game changers like Zlatan, like Edinson Cavani. They've got Lucas Moura, who's been on the mend and playing a lot better recently. I mean, they've just got, I think, you know, as good as City is, the talent from 1 to, you know, 13, 14 at PSG is just a little bit more than what City's got. And I think ultimately when it comes down to that, even if it comes down to, you know, those extra 120 minutes or those extra, you know, half an hour at the end, I think that's what's going to see PSG through. The best thing City could hope for, I think, going into the home leg is just, you know, draw it out. Don't give up, you know, draw it out 1-1. Don't, you know, no 2-2s or anything like that.
Right, right.
And get to penalties and try and go through that way.
Yeah, I thought, from City perspective first, I thought De Bruyne was magnificent today. He was excellent in the game against Bournemouth on Sunday. But of course, you know, it's Bournemouth, so you don't really take too much.
Bournemouth are a tough team, though. I mean,
yeah, I agree. But of course, there's still a huge difference between Bournemouth and PSG. So in this game, I thought Yeah, he was probably one of the best players on the pitch. He was given a free role, Morgan. We've got so used to seeing him play as either an attacking three or one of the wingers that see him. I really enjoyed seeing him play in this free role. It was a traditional Trek Artista role that you usually don't see anymore from English teams away in the Champions League. And huge credit to Pellegrini, because De Bruyne, even though he kind of faded towards the last 10-15 minutes, probably because of the fact that he's still coming back to full fitness, he was excellent. Got on the ball, even played some defense, was involved in both goals. Terrific, terrific performance by De Bruyne.
Yeah, and again, not shocking at all. Mm-hmm. You knew, even when he was at Chelsea, you knew De Bruyne was a good talent. He's probably, him and Lukaku, in my mind, are the two biggest that they sold off that's going to end up biting them in the ass for a long, long time, unless they somehow manage to pry him back, which I highly doubt they will. Mm-hmm. Given him that free role.
That's until you guys let Falcao go. He's going to be the real one you'll regret.
Yeah, Falcao's going to be the one we really regret, yeah.
So, Morgan, go ahead.
He is such a creative. I was just going to say, with De Bruyne, I mean, he's such a creative player that a free role like that does fit him. And exactly. That's something that, when he was at Chelsea, when he did get playing time, he was shunted out onto the wing. Mm-hmm. And, again, at Wolfsburg, I didn't really get a chance to watch him a whole lot there at Wolfsburg. I'm sure they gave him a little bit of free reign, but a lot of the time you saw him, he was out on that wing doing his thing. And I think that he's one of those guys that, yes, he knows how to do the job on the wing, but if you absolutely need him to, I think he can really excel in that free role there. I just think that there are some players that these teams like City and Chelsea and Wolfsburg trust a little bit more in that free role than he does at this point, mainly because of his age.
Yeah, so a couple other things I want to bring up. First thing is that maybe 10 minutes into the game, everyone that was watching this game online using the Fox Soccer Go app was magically switched to Fox News for about 25 minutes. And I kept wondering, it's pretty funny. Like, depending on who you are, maybe that's a good thing, I guess. But, we missed a penalty save. We missed a goal. So we missed all kinds of stuff. But I kept thinking to myself, I wonder how much of, an intersection is there in the sets that watch soccer and follow Fox News. And I wonder if anyone can do that stat for us. It would be pretty interesting.
I don't think there's a whole lot either. At this point, with Fox, you could tell me that they showed 5 minutes of the game and then tried to air like a debate or something like that in a Champions League game. I wouldn't be shocked. It seems like the ineptitude of Fox when it comes to airing soccer, and not just the Champions League. I mean, we saw things like this when they had the Premier League. We've seen things like this with the Bundesliga, where they've either messed up the feeds, they're putting the biggest games on second channels. I mean, it really, at this point, it almost seems like they have soccer around just to say, hey, we were the guys that had it first.
Right.
I mean, should NBC get those? I don't know. I mean, I don't know that NBC, I think they're doing well with just the Premier League right now, and I think they should probably just keep that set up. But maybe start seeing those other leagues like the Bundesliga, like the Champions League, going to something like BN, who actually is set up to take care of these things. I wouldn't be shocked if Fox got outbid in the next couple of years for those rights.
Yeah, it's interesting. BN picked up NASL over here, North American Soccer League, so yes. I'm interested to see
the Miami FC Fort Lauderdale game. Mm-hmm.
Yep, watch Indy 11 this weekend. You might be able to see me waving in the crowd. So Morgan, let's one last point about this game. So an interesting point made by by one of the Fox commentators, I'm not sure who it was, talked about how one of the reasons he sees why PSG capitulated in this game is he felt that PSG have not played enough high-intensity games because they've been strolling through Ligue 1 and just walking away with games, and City have had to play high intensity games week in, week out. And I found it interesting because it's the exact reverse of the argument that teams from England struggle in the Champions League because they worked too hard week to week. So what are your thoughts on that argument?
I did a lot of research. I want to say about a week or two ago, right when PSG had clinched the league, I want to say the game was against Troyes. Bottom team in the league, put 7 past them,
right?
And you're like, all right, this
barely kind of broke a sweat.
Cherry on top of the season. This is the type of result that, And what the thing to me is that I don't know that it's the level of competition. Because if you look at the rest of Ligue 1, you're seeing a lot of these, a lot of teams who aren't your traditional Marseilles, your Bordeaux, your Lilles, your Lyons. I mean, these are teams that are, you know, in the 4th through 12th range right now. Mm-hmm. They're no longer making up the top 4, 5, 6. I think that there is a lot more competition in France than a lot of people give it credit for. There are a lot more really good players in France than a lot of people give them credit for. I just think it's a little bit more spaced out. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I'd say is the difference is that PSG just is that much higher as far as the level of talent goes. So does that mean that they're not playing high-intensity games? No, they're playing very, very good teams. They're just that level above to the point where, right, you know, it looks a lot worse. You know, mm. I mean, you get a team, you know, that's playing against PSG and it's 1-0 until the 75th minute and then they just break it open.
Yeah.
I mean, when you can do that, yeah, you can do that. It doesn't mean you didn't play a hard-fought game. It just means towards the end, that's when everything came together, when the, you know, either the other team faded or, you know, just the level of talent just mm-hmm. became that much more with PSG. So I don't know that it's necessarily that they're not playing high intensity games. I mean, you know, what's a high intensity game? I mean, is it just end to end stuff? I mean, is it a team that wins 1-0 like Leicester? I mean, are Leicester playing high intensity games every week, just winning 1-0? I mean, I see more people criticizing them for that,
right,
than they are, you know, praising them for, put, you know, for you know, winning these games or playing these high intensity games. So I think it really is subjective. I think a lot of people who don't watch the French league will just kind of write it off as, you know, oh, PSG are just so much better. They're romping over like it's the Belgian league or something like that,
right,
or
right,
you know, the Turkmenistani league or something. But mm-hmm. it's really not.
It's one of my favorite leagues, the Turkmenistani.
The Turkmen league, yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, let's move, Morgan. Let's move ahead to the final game here. Wolfsburg with an incredible result against Real Madrid. I don't think anyone predicted this. I thought Real Madrid would be winning this game 2-0, but the first half, it just, the worst things. So in the preview pod, Gabe and I talked about this, last week's review pod where we previewed these games. I talked about how one of the areas that could be explored by Wolfsburg using Draxler is that left-back spot with Marcelo, because we know Marcelo loves to bomb forward, and it's not a surprise that in this game, one goal and about three chances that weren't goals came from passes from that side, because Marcelo was caught forward, or the person in front of Marcelo, which was often Bale and occasionally Cristiano, did not track back. So it's an area that Wolfsburg exploited magnificently, and they have probably the best result of all four games.
Yeah, and you know, really, this is something that I do have a couple of thoughts on with Real Madrid, and I actually just got done reading Sid Lowe's Fear and Loathing in La Liga. Mm-hmm. Highly recommend if you get a chance. You know, it really does kind of give you in-depth. But one of the points that he made in there, something kind of towards the latter stages of, you know, to where we're at now, not the mm-hmm. early, you know, 30s, 40s, and 50s, is that Madrid has become so obsessed with Barcelona that they've created teams designed just to beat Barcelona. And what you're seeing now, and you're seeing it a lot this year, and you saw it a lot in the past, you've seen it a lot the past couple of years, is that they have trouble against teams who aren't Barcelona. So they have these players that, yes, they're magnificent players, but they're put in positions and they're lined up in a way that other teams can exploit them rather than just, you know, rather than Barcelona. And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, a guy like Marcelo, who has played against Barcelona, who has done well against Barcelona, gets caught out against these teams that know how to play against a weak left back. You know, I mean, you don't have teams that have short little Jordi Alba that's going to get, you know, bowled over by
right
Gareth Bale like he did in the Clásico. You know, Ricardo Rodriguez, who not only is a fantastic wrestling manager and announcer, also plays as one of the best left backs in the world. You know,
there's your one wrestling reference.
Exactly. But when you're playing against good, you know, when Madrid had to play against really good backs like that, I mean, it does. I mean, you can see it kind of stunts them a little
bit, yeah,
you know, because they don't have the physicality. They're, you know, they're not winning the balls in the air. They can't just boss these guys around. And again, Dani Alves has been one of the best right backs in the world for, you know, what, 5 years now. He's even starting to show cracks. So you've seen mm-hmm. it again in the Clásicos on there. So you're seeing a Madrid team who, when they're going up against a team that they should beat no matter what, just because the names on the team sheet are still set up mainly to beat a team like Barcelona when you're come up against a team like Wolfsburg, who are, you know, at this point going to be considered scrappy, up and coming, a little bit tougher, they're going to run into a lot more trouble. And I think that a result like this, while it is shocking on paper, when you really sit down and look at it, you know, maybe, yeah, Wolfsburg coming in did have a little bit of a tactical advantage. Excuse me.
It's been tactical advantage, I think, comes down to the way they set up in midfield, because you had Gilavegi, and apologize for that pronunciation, the number 23.
I've not known how to say his name, and I've seen his name for the last like 4 years. I have no idea.
French, actually, you know, interesting. He used to play for Atletico. He got let go by Atletico. 23. He's 20. He's a young, still a young central midfielder from France. He's been playing in the French team as well. So he really caught my eye today, Morgan. I thought he was excellent. He played basically for the first half, man marked Kroos out of the game. And then he wasn't playing so much man-marking in the second half, but he was pressing both Kroos as well as Modric. And then that allowed Luis Gustavo to really switch the play quickly to either the forward, and Schürrle was playing as a false nine, or to Draxler, or to Arnold behind Schürrle, or Henrique on the wing. So it was a very simple tactical setup, a really good traditional 4-2-3-1. But the play of Gilavegi, again, apologize for the pronunciation, allowed Luis Gustavo to do what he does best. And I think that's something that Real Madrid will have to consider. Zidane will have to consider tactically how to nullify Luis Gustavo getting on the ball. And the key to that, apparently, is getting on Gilavegi. So we'll see. All right, let's move ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, so let's wrap up section one here, Morgan, and we will be back for section two, where we'll talk about Conte to your beloved Chelsea and preview Dortmund versus Liverpool. You're listening to the World Soccer Talk podcast. We'll be right back. So we're going to start section two with a bit of a correction. Morgan informed me just as soon as we stopped recording section one that he is actually still an Atletico player. So thank you for that, Morgan. He's on loan, I guess.
Gilavogi, not myself.
Yeah. Morgan is now playing for Atletico and for Wolfsburg.
He's been with Atletico since 2013, and then he's done two loans. He went to Saint-Étienne, did okay there, which was his club before when they bought him, and he's now on loan at Wolfsburg, where he's been on loan at Wolfsburg for 2 years now.
Oh, okay.
That's awesome. He's really kind of come into his own there. So
I have to admit, time I watched him was in a French shirt, so I didn't notice him, and then I saw him play today, and I was like, I remember that name. And then I remembered who he was, but I forgot that he was still an Atletico player. So, Morgan, let's talk about the big news this week. It was officially announced that Antonio Conte is now going to be Chelsea manager at the end of the World Cup. So as a Chelsea supporter, I think this is perfect to have you to talk about this. First of all, there should be a caveat for any listener who hasn't heard Morgan talk about Chelsea. Bias is coming. It'll be my job to set him straight, you guys.
The truth.
So let's start this conversation with the general idea that some people in the media have had, and I think I kind of agree with this in some ways, is that Chelsea are really still trying to recreate Mourinho 1.0, because Conte, in a lot of ways, is like Mourinho. He has that same fire. Depending on who you ask, he has more fire and is harder on his players. But give me your thoughts on that. Are Chelsea still stuck in 2005?
I don't think they're stuck in 2005. I mean, obviously, if they were, they'd keep Mourinho around. You know, the thing about Conte to me, again, he's a hard worker. He does a lot of research. That's the one thing that I'm sure if you've read any of the articles on him, he does a lot of research, a lot of video research. Yes, he is tough on his players, but you haven't seen the cracks that have come out where Mourinho, he can be tough, but he can also be, I'm not going to bleep it on here, but he can be an a-hole to the other set of players that he doesn't use. Conte, to me at least, seems to be, from what I've read, almost universally loved by all of his players. It's that tough love that he gives them, and they actually end up respecting it, whereas he's not just out in the press down talking a guy or just calling guys out for no reason, trying to create unnecessary drama. I think that's the biggest difference between the two is he's just, he's tough on his players, demands respect, but also gives them the same amount of respect that they deserve, mm-hmm. rather than, just creating whatever drama that needs to come in on there. The other misconception that I've seen from Conte is that he's a 3-5-2 man, mm-hmm. which, yes, it's a very popular style that he's played. He had a lot of success with it with Italy. He's had a lot of success with it with Juventus. But if you go back to, and you actually do look at some of the positioning and the tactics that he's played at some of the previous teams that he was at, really, he played with what he had. Mm-hmm. When you're playing with Barry, you can't go out and just buy whoever you want at center back. So he does have that. He does have the ability to fluctuate his tactics. I'm sure he has one tactic that he is comfortable with and one tactic that if they can do it, he knows he can win with. But if he has to, he can move it around. The good news is coming in with Chelsea, he's going to be able to, not buy whoever he wants, but he can buy players that are going to fit right. whatever system he wants to play. And there are a lot of players at Chelsea, not just, in the youth ranks, but also out on loan, that he could probably have his pick of the litter and get whoever he wants. I mean, Christ, he's finally going to get Juan Cuadrado. Cuadrado is only on loan at Juventus, and it doesn't look like they're going to end up buying him. So he's mm-hmm. finally going to get a player that he's coveted for a while. So we might be able to see that on there. I don't necessarily think they're stuck. I mean, the only thing they're stuck in about 2005 is that they want to dominate like it's 2005. I'd say that's the only thing that they're stuck in.
Fair enough. Now, tell me, one of the things that I think we should also consider is that I think, from my perspective, Antonio Conte is obviously a good manager. I think what he did at Juventus was magnificent. He literally dragged them out of the abyss that was having just got promoted from Serie B after the whole scandal. I mean, there were other managers who went there. Ranieri was there, things of that nature. But it wasn't until Conte showed up that Juventus really started to dominate football and became the power that they once were. And I think it's largely down to Conte that started that. He's done well with Italy. Now, one of the things that is still being brought up right now, Morgan, is this match fixing scandal. So the report is that while he was at Siena, which he was in Serie B at the time, this is a claim of one of the people involved in the scandal, that Conte knew about the scandal, knew about what was going on because he addressed it in the locker room. This was not corroborated by any of the players and it remains largely contested, and contradicted by Conte and his legal, personnel. But the issue is there are reports that he might be getting fined or even serving some jail time. So how does that, what are your thoughts on that whole situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, from what I've seen, it's been like a 6-month ban, I think, is what they're calling for as well. Mm-hmm. My thoughts on it, it's Italy, it's Serie B, where stuff like that happens all the time. I mean, there's been countless, articles, books written on the corruption that's just rife throughout, not just, the lower leagues. I mean, it's been in Serie A as well. We've seen two huge scandals since then.
Yep.
Does that, do you just dismiss it? No, you don't. Whether he knew about it or not, I don't know. I mean, there are certain times where I've seen it discussed where, yes, the players knew about it, the manager maybe didn't. It's kind of hard for the manager not to know about it, I'm sure, at that point. But if it does come back and he was, he does get implicated, he did know about it, he, obviously should serve his time. He should serve whatever the ban is, serve whatever's up on there, and then go from there. Is there some sort of release clause? Do I not want him to be Chelsea manager? No, obviously not. I'd love for him to be the Chelsea manager one way or another, but it's, I think when you're in that environment of, Serie B, where it's okay, we know you're going up, we're possibly going down, here's X, please help us stay up.
Right.
It's one of those things that it's always there. It's rife, and you just kind of adapt to your environment that you're in. Does that mean that there's going to be a match fixing scandal in England now that Conte's there? I highly doubt it. England, to me at least, seems like one of the more relegated leagues. I could be wrong. You never know. I mean, we just had this whole Panama paper thing come out.
Right,
there could
right.
be something come out. Yeah, there could be something come out with this, but at least the Premier League gives itself off as one of the more regulated when it comes to match fixing, when it comes to especially the higher levels. And when you're at the level of the Premier League, that it's almost impossible to do something like that. At least it would seem to be that way to me.
So final thing about Conte, I'll give you the names of a couple of players, and I want you to tell me whether you see them at Chelsea next year. It doesn't have to be you don't have to explain much. Maybe just in a minute we'll wrap this part up. So John Terry and Diego Costa, Chelsea next season, not?
I think that Terry will be there next season. Will he be playing? I don't know. Costa, I think he will be there next season.
Okay. All right. And this is obviously a story that will continue to develop. As we know, Conte will be busy with Italy well into the summer. So transfer dealings and all that stuff will probably only start up in July. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Let's preview the Dortmund-Liverpool game here, Morgan. By the time many of our listeners will listen to this, the game will either be on. So we'll do this very briefly. The big, obviously, talking points are Klopp going back to his beloved previous club, where he is loved and adored by all the fan base.
Loved.
So what I want to ask you is, can you see Liverpool? So when Gabe and I previewed this game on ULF Podcast on Monday, my thought was that the only way Liverpool can pull off going through in this tie is if they have the best defensive performance of their entire season. I know they have a lot of attacking talent up front. I appreciate how good Coutinho is. I appreciate how good Firmino has been in the last 4 or 5 months. But I think given the talent in that Dortmund team, Gundogan has started training. So I cannot see a way that Liverpool can hold them off enough to go through unless they have an incredible defensive performance.
I tend to agree with you on that. I think that you look at not just the attacking talent, but the talent overall at Dortmund is at another level. I think when you compare it to Liverpool on there from front to back, to me, it's going to depend on who they put in goal for Dortmund. Obviously, if you put Roman Weidenfeller in there, as it seems they've done a lot in the European games, you've got a little bit more of a chance. He's a decent keeper, but he's prone to a mistake here and there. and that's the thing. It just takes one mistake to turn a tie like that, especially when the teams play evenly. If Liverpool do have one of the best
that works out perfectly because Mignolet is at the other side.
Exactly, yeah, and that's the other thing. You've got Simon Mignolet, who is also prone to gaffes. So we could see a 5-4. Who knows?
Right.
But obviously, I think if they put Roman Berkey in, you're going to see it. It's just going to be that much tougher when you come up against Dortmund. I think that Tuchel has taken them to another level of where Klopp's playing style was.
Mm-hmm.
So you're building on it. You're kind of advancing past it. So. And the other thing, you got Firmino, who's been playing well. You've got the other little Brazilian guy that you just said.
Coutinho.
Blanking on again, I apologize. Coutinho.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I mean, there's not a whole lot on the strike force. I mean, you're going to have to rely on what, Christian Benteke?
He's injured, so he's not going to be playing. So Firmino will probably play with Sturridge and Coutinho,
But even Sturridge. Bridge too. I mean, he's another one who's he's a hamstring tweak away from exiting the game. So I mean, there's not a whole lot of confidence you have up at the front and the back. Again, I mean, when you have to give, it's one thing to give one life changing performance, is a whole other thing to do it twice. So I think when you get there, if you go over two legs with these guys, it's going to be, I think Dortmund is going to end up coming out on top, but. Yeah, it should still be a fun game. I think the atmosphere that you'll see with Klopp returning to the club, I think it'll be a fun atmosphere, at least to see for the TIFOs and everything like that.
I think one of the things Liverpool supporters should be happy about is that every time Klopp's Liverpool have come up against a big team, they've tended to do well. This has been true in the league. It's been true in Europa this season. So even though Dortmund go in as heavy favorites, based on what we saw against Spurs in the weekend, I think Liverpool fans will have some confidence. And I might, you know, you can't rule out an upset, especially based on what we saw with Wolfsburg Real Madrid.
Yeah.
So we'll wrap up section two here. In section three, we'll preview three key games in the Premier League. And that will be it for tonight's World Soccer Talk podcast. We'll be right back. In the final section of tonight's podcast, we will be previewing three games that we think will have that have major repercussions for either the title race or the relegation battle. And those three games will be Southampton, Newcastle, Sunderland, Leicester City, and Tottenham, Manchester United. So let's start with the Southampton, Newcastle game, Morgan. This game has huge relegation implications. With Norwich 6 points ahead, having played a game more, this is a must-win game for Rafa Benitez's Newcastle. However, Southampton are unbeaten in the last five against Newcastle, Morgan. Southampton have won five of their last seven Premier League games. Newcastle, on the other hand, winless in six. Real, real uphill task for Newcastle.
It really is. Honestly, after the last game, I really think that Newcastle are done.
Yeah.
You know, Benitez, for what you can think of him as a manager, what you think that he's done, he's not that miracle worker. You know, he's not taken a team from the brink of relegation and gotten them safe. He's more, okay, things are going well, let's go to the top and push at that point. So I think it was a strange appointment to me, mainly because it seemed like he was just done for the name recognition value at that point, because he hasn't really done this. And if he has done it, it's been years since he's done it. So, you know, I think Newcastle are done. I mean, at this point, Rafa doesn't really have anything to lose because he doesn't have to go to the championship with this team if they end up going down. And honestly, going down might be the best thing for Newcastle, but we said that last time. We're right back down here. So, I mean, it does have implications. You're coming up against a strong Southampton side who has been playing very well, who has beaten them on the regular. I just can't see a result in Newcastle's way in any way. I can't really see anything that Newcastle does where they end up winning this game. I just can't.
Yeah, about a month and a half ago, I thought Newcastle were not going to get relegated. But based especially on last week's result, I'm in agreement with you. I think they're in serious trouble, and a loss in this game pretty much guarantees that. And I guess this is a good time as any to announce that Kristen Hennage, Newcastle United supporter, will be rejoining the World Soccer Talk podcast, and he'll be joining us on Sunday to talk about this game and everything else. So you can look forward to that. Newcastle's relegation battlers, as well as local rivals, Sunderland, will be playing Leicester City. This game has repercussions both at the bottom end and the top end, Morgan. Sunderland have won 1 in 10. Ranieri's team is doing terrifically well. They've been winning 1-0 all the time. Goals are coming from a variety of players, not just Mahrez, not just Vardy. Okazaki scored a worldie in the international break. If you didn't get a chance to see that, that was a brilliant goal. The confidence is high. And honestly, Morgan, if Leicester wins, which I think they will, and Spurs drop points against United, the title race will be over this weekend.
Yep. I mean, well, what's the magic numbers now? 12 points, right? I think that's what the magic number is for Leicester City.
Right. If they win and Spurs draws, I think they will be 9 points ahead of Spurs.
Yeah, which again, a lot of points to make up. I don't even. You're probably right on there that it will be, but again, we're looking at a team like Leicester City who has never been up at this point.
Right,
so,
but neither has Spurs.
Really,
so
outside of a double-digit lead, a lot of people are going to question that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, if I could just control C, control P my Newcastle analysis to this one, I would. I mean, you know, Sunderland, again, just.
You mean control like V, right? Because control P is print. I don't know how printing would help you.
Well, no, I would print. No, I would print it out and then I would send.
then you would paste it. Okay.
Got it. I would paste. Yeah. Control paste. Yes. No, but yeah, I mean, you know, again, Sunderland. Nothing that the Northeast is offering right now football-wise that would bring you any confidence or any reason to think that they could pull off a major upset. You know, Big Sam is a guy who has done it before, pull teams out of relegation, granted, from his own doing. But I just think that at this point, the way these two teams are set up, the way, you know, the mentality, just the way that everything's been going, I think this is the year that you kind of see the Northeast disappear from the Premier League, at least for next season. I can't see them, especially like you said, Leicester's pulling goals out of nowhere, different guys stepping up a different different time. I mean, you know, Wes Morgan pulled one up
right
the other day. I mean, it's, you know, they just seem to be that team of destiny, and coming up against a team like Sunderland, you know, Sunderland doesn't beat the team of, or yeah, they don't beat the team of destiny at that point. There's just no way.
Yeah, I think I'm in agreement with you. Not only is Leicester flying high right now, I think Sunderland's own issues. I think the best thing Sunderland did last week was a couple of chances that Defoe created, and he couldn't put those away. Yeah. Had he put those away, I think we would be there. Sunderland would have come into this game with some confidence. But Leicester City's
just... Had he been able to put things like that away consistently,
he wouldn't be at Sunderland.
he wouldn't be Jermaine Defoe.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that just feeds back into the point of there. You know, these are teams that there's a reason they are where they are at this mm-hmm. point. And yeah. You know, it's not the early season. You know, you can go in and talk about defensive frailties, offensive, you know, ineptitude, but at this point, you really do know what these teams are, and it's just it really is hard at this point to really make a tactical argument as to why they might be able to pull it out. I mean, there's maybe a 1% chance Sunderland, I think, pulls this out into a victory for themselves.
Yeah, from a U.S. men's national team perspective, the recent ban for Emmanuel Eboué might mean that DeAndre Yedlin actually gets playing time again for Sunderland. But that will also mean that he'll be coming up against Mahrez, so he might be wishing or hoping that that ban hadn't gone through.
Yeah. In him a lot.
Yes. I mean, the thing is that Yedlin will match Mahrez for pace any day of the week. But the problem is Mahrez's trickery, his ability to play with both feet, his ability to cut inside is really going to trouble Yedlin, who's improved. He's improved as a defender, to be honest. He has improved as a defender, but he's still not up to Premier League standard.
And that's the thing. I mean, it's not like they're going off into a foot race. You know, this isn't the 100-meter dash. This is football, where you do other things than run in a straight line, unless you play for Big Sam.
there's a Jesus Navas joke somewhere in there, but I won't make it. Yeah. All right, so let's talk Tottenham Manchester United final game. We'll preview big repercussions in terms of the top four race, big repercussions in terms of the title race. United will need to win this game because City are going to be playing West Brom, whom they will fairly comfortably beat. In spite of what Toni Pulis is able to put up defensively, which is a lot, which means that once City goes clear, 4 points at that point clear of United, United's going to have to win to get back to the 1 point difference which exists right now. Whereas Spurs dropping any sort of points, as we mentioned when we were previewing the Leicester City game, is pretty much game over in most people's opinion for the title, because after that, Leicester City play four teams that are teams that they've already beaten earlier this season. So Tottenham, Manchester United, Morgan, your thoughts?
I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, it is a big game for both of them in both races that they're chasing. I mean, obviously Manchester United finishing outside of the top five again is going to be a huge, huge issue, especially for Van Gaal and his legacy.
His legacy.
I mean, Spurs, again, they're playing with house money at this point. You know, I mean, it's a good season. I think the biggest thing for them is it's not just the title, too. I think there's a little bit creeping in of we need to finish above Arsenal. And I think that's something that's right there in the back of Pochettino's mind, that he's, you know, he's trying to turn the mentality around in this team to not just be the younger brother. I mean, they want to be the big boy on the block at London, mm-hmm. and right now they are. I mean, there's no way you can argue with 4 points up on Arsenal and however many up on Chelsea, right. Not as many up on West Ham, but still. I mean, it's, you know, when you're trying to turn this team around, one of the biggest things you can do, I highly doubt they would have been in this place at this point of the year, going into the season. And so as far as the title race goes, yeah, they're playing with house money. They're going to play loose. They're going to play relaxed. I think they're going to play well, but I think that the biggest thing for them going into this is also going to be making sure that they get the points to not only finish as high as they can, but to finish above Arsenal, just to break that streak and to break that hold mentally that Arsenal has held over them for, what, 20, 30 years now, however long that stupid holiday has been going on for.
Yeah, this would be the first time in 50 years that Spurs would have won the league. I think it's very unlikely at this point. But yeah, United have a really good record against Spurs at White Hart Lane. United have not been beaten at White Hart Lane since 2000. Glenn Hoddle was the last manager to beat United at White Hart Lane. Having said that, I think this Spurs team is very different from any Spurs team we have seen since 2000. And they come into this game heavy favorites because I think Manchester United's inability to create chances mixed with Spurs' excellent defensive structure and excellent midfield gives them a huge advantage over United. And let's not forget that Harry Kane has beaten the best defenders in the world on his day. So I think Smalling and Daley Blind will be looking over their shoulder the whole time. And also, I think the two of the three best goalkeepers in the world match up in this game as well. Now, if you have any feedback or questions for the review pod that we'll be doing on Sunday, tweet at me using hashtag WSTpod at NipunChopra7. You can find Morgan at Morgan_Green, Karthik at KKFLA737, and let's just say we have a pretty awesome guest, as I've mentioned, in Chris Henage, lined up for Sunday's podcast. Long-term listeners of the pod will be enjoying the way we're restructuring the podcast. Until then, on behalf of Chris Harris, everyone at World Soccer Talk, Morgan Green, this is Nipun Chopra saying enjoy your football.